Afternoon. For those of you who were expecting a sermon from Heath, our regular and professional preacher, sorry about that. For those of you who knew I was going to be preaching and decided to come anyways, I appreciate that. The subject of this afternoon's sermon is going to be the trial of Jesus. Now, I will freely admit that when we started this morning and Heath started immediately talking about Jesus in the Praetorium, I thought I was in trouble, but the subject ended up being perfectly in tune with this afternoon sermon. Before we get started, for those of you who like PowerPoint presentations, as I've mentioned before, I've yet to learn PowerPoint, and while I thought about doing it for this sermon, it seemed that running a business and putting together a sermon and learning to use PowerPoint all at the same time seemed to be a little bit more than I wanted to take on, but maybe once I retire, I'll learn it. Some of you may remember, actually very few of you as I look out over the room, this is actually a retelling of my very first sermon as a very young man. I'm guessing it was about 27 or 28 years ago when Weldon Warnick approached me and said he was thinking of putting together a sermon on the trial of Jesus, and since I was a new attorney at the time, he approached me and said, I think you would be more qualified to do that than I would. Well, while I differed with him significantly, he still prevailed upon me, and this sermon was put together at his request. Several years ago, the thought of redoing the sermon came to me, and I sort of shrugged it off, thinking, oh, no, I've already done that before. Everybody's heard it. But a couple months ago, one Sunday morning, I sort of looked around the auditorium and realized that since it was about 27 years ago, virtually everybody under about 37 probably didn't hear it. A lot of our members who did hear it are no longer with us, and there was about 10 people on each side of the room who would have been here that day, and frankly, two or three of them on each side probably remember it. So I thought it was safe to try it again. So that's what we're going to do. Now, a couple things to explain about a study of the trial of Jesus before we get started. First of all, when we talk about a trial, or we use the word trial, the first thing that comes to our mind is a single event. You know, we see stories about trials on TV, and it's always a proceeding in a courtroom with a judge and a jury, and by the end of the show, they've made a decision. Well, that's not really what happened regarding the trial of Jesus. The trial of Jesus should actually be more accurately considered as the trials, plural, of Jesus. In fact, there were six distinct and different steps that were involved in the process from the moment of his arrest till the time of his crucifixion. And we're going to discuss briefly each one of those six events. The other thing I will point out to you is the volume of information that we could discuss regarding the trial of Jesus, from talking about all of the factual issues starting with his arrest and ending with his eventual death, and then throwing in a little bit of information about Jewish law and a little bit of information about Roman law. If you're going to do that in depth, that could easily be a 4 to 5, maybe even a 6 sermon series. I assure you, that's not what we're going to do here today. So we're going to look at it more of as more like a survey and just cover the basic topics as we go along. In other words, it's going to be pretty entry level. So what are those 6 distinct stages that I mentioned? Well, again, we all know about the incidents of Jesus' arrest, and we know about his eventual crucifixion. Now we're going to talk about everything in the middle. The first step, after he was arrested, Jesus was taken before Annas. That was sort of like a preliminary hearing, is the best way to explain it. After that, he was sent from Annas to the high priest, or Caiaphas. And then once that part of the trial was over, when morning came, they had another proceeding before the high priest, the Sanhedrin. And then when the Sanhedrin was done with them, he was sent before Pilate. Pilate, looking for a way to avoid being involved in this process, sends him to Herod. Herod doesn't really do anything with him, sends him back before Pilate one more time. So there were six distinct steps in this process leading up to Jesus' death. Now, before we talk about the details of those six steps, it would be helpful if we knew a little bit about some of the basic principles of both Jewish law and Roman law. With regard to the Jewish law, I'm going to go over a few things. Some of them are going to be right out of the Old Testament. Some of the information will have been taken from the Talmud, which is the book of Jewish law. And I want you to know that the things that I'm going to cover in this list aren't everything that's relevant to the events that happened with Jesus on that last day. Again, I'm just going to touch on some of the less technical Jewish law issues. First of all, it was a basic premise of Jewish law that a minimum of two witnesses is required to find someone guilty of a crime. In fact, if you will turn with me to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 17, verse 6. And it says, "Whoever is deserving of death shall be put to death on the testimony of two or three witnesses. He shall not be put to death on the testimony of one witness." Now, even though here in the book of Deuteronomy they're talking about the death penalty, I want you to be aware that this is a general principle of all law, not just death penalty cases. But in this particular instance, they are specifically talking about the death penalty. And if you read that passage literally, if it takes two witnesses, what that means is even if the defendant admits to his guilt, there has to be separate evidence of his guilt. And to a certain extent, that principle, though to a lesser degree, is even followed in our modern-day judicial system. But the point is, two witnesses, even if one of them is the defendant himself, you still need more evidence. And if you think about it, in today's modern society, one of the reasons we do that is to protect defendants who may be suffering from some mental illness from themselves. In other words, just because somebody walks into a police station and says, "I killed somebody," doesn't mean we take them out back and crucify them. So that's why the general principle is there even today. Another basic principle, and it may sound redundant, but it needs to be said. Defendants in the Jewish legal system were promised and guaranteed a fair and impartial trial. Let's take a look at Deuteronomy 13, verses 13 and 14. It says, "Corrupt men have gone out from among you and enticed the inhabitants of their city, saying, 'Let us go and serve other gods, which you have not known.' Then you shall inquire, search out, and ask diligently. And if it is indeed true and certain that such an abomination was committed among you, you shall surely strike the inhabitants of that city." Now, what they're pointing out here isn't just that a defendant is guaranteed an impartial trial. But when they're saying that the judges should inquire, search out, and ask diligently, that means you should be, as a judge, you should be the one searching for the truth, not advocating a certain position. That's what the prosecutor in today's modern system is for. They're advocating for the guilt of the party. The defense counsel is advocating for the innocence of the party. Those two persons have distinct and unique roles in our judicial system, but the judge should be impartial, and he should not be involved in presenting evidence or prejudging evidence. He should be looking for the truth. Another general rule of Jewish law was that a judgment would take place a day after the trial. In other words, they took the position that, and especially in a death penalty case, they required a 3-day waiting period. And the purpose behind this was to simply provide for a cooling off period. Because let's be realistic, even in our country, in today's modern system, it's not unusual, particularly in a very violent crime, for the general public to sort of prejudge what happened or who did it. Well, the Jewish system took the approach that, okay, we're going to have a trial, but we're going to wait a day after all the evidence is presented to pass judgment. That's to make sure cool heads are involved in the decision-making process. Another one is, and we're all familiar with this concept, and that is the fact that there is a basic presumption of innocence. And that means if you are accused of a crime in some tribunal, the law presumes going into the trial that you are innocent. And the state has the burden of proving, in our society, we use the phrase, beyond a reasonable doubt, not only that a crime has been committed, but you are in fact the person who committed that crime. So that presumption of innocence is not something new to our system. The Jewish system included that as one of their basic tenets as well. Also, another basic concept that we follow to this day in our country is the fact that the accused cannot be compelled to testify against himself. We've all, again, seen the cop shows and the trial shows on TV. Every defendant has the right to remain silent, and he's warned that anything he says can and may be held against him in a court of law. We call that the Miranda warning. So every person who's put under arrest in our country has a constitutional right to be told of that right to remain silent. Some of them do, some of them don't. But the point is, the accused cannot be compelled to offer testimony that could be used against him. Another very unique concept in the Jewish system was the fact that a person who offers false testimony, we would refer to him as a false witness, could be subject to the same penalty for the same crime as the person he is accusing. And we can take a look at that in Deuteronomy 19, starting at verse 16. And it says, if a false witness rises against any man to testify against him of wrongdoing, then both men in the controversy shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and judges who serve in those days. And the judges shall make careful inquiry, and indeed, if the witness is a false witness who has testified falsely against his brother, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother. So you shall put away the evil from among you. So again, if somebody offers false testimony at a criminal trial, he may be subject to the very same penalty of the person that he was offering that testimony against. Another unique part of the Jewish system was the fact that court procedures were to occur during the daytime and in public. Now what's the big deal? Well, the purpose was to keep it open and make sure it was all above board. In other words, you want to engender confidence that the system is working appropriately. What's the best way to do that? Well, have the proceedings be open to the public and have them during the day instead of 3 o'clock in the morning. And that way, everybody has an opportunity to watch what's going on. So that was, in Jewish times, that was one of the ways that they protected, if you will, the integrity of the system. Another unique part of the Jewish system is a very unusual fact. If, in fact, the Sanhedrin finds somebody guilty unanimously, that means all 70, 71 people in the council believes that this person is guilty, the defendant is actually set free. Why is that? Well, the Jewish people elected to create a presumption, if you will, that basically says, well, wait a minute. If 70 people are convinced of somebody's guilt, and there's not one person in that group who can find it in his heart to grant this person some level of mercy, then there must be something inherently wrong with that case. There must be something inherently unfair about the way the evidence was submitted. So again, if believe it or not, if the decision of the council is unanimous, the defendant is set free. And then finally, one more, there would be absolutely no court proceedings on the Sabbath or the day before the Sabbath. And like I said before, I could probably come up with another whole sheet of things for us to talk about. A lot of them would be super technical. A lot of them wouldn't necessarily apply to the trial of Jesus. But for our study, those are some basic tenets that you need to keep in mind as we go forward. Now, it's also important to understand the difference between the Jewish system and the Roman system. Those of us who are familiar with the actual civil history at the time, we know that Rome at this point pretty much rules the world. They're being run by an emperor in Rome, and Judah at this time is considered a protectorate. It's almost like being a for instance, in our country, we're vaguely aware probably that we have certain territories. I think Puerto Rico is a territory of the United States. Guam is a territory. They're not quite states, but we have some control over them. That would be similar to the situation that we're looking at here with what we now refer to as the Middle East. That's the kind of power and control Rome had over that part of the world. On the other hand, the Roman leaders were smart enough to realize that it would be important for these people to have some semblance of what we would refer to as home rule. And so for that reason, the Romans allowed there to be some Jewish legal system with customary issues. The problem with that, though, is, if you think about it, while the Jewish court system could render decisions, they really had no way to, at least in a criminal case, they really had no way to impose a sentence. In fact, they were forbidden by law, by Roman law, from exercising capital punishment. So, to a certain extent, they are a legal system without any teeth. And most major legal issues in the Jewish system would have been decided by the Sanhedrin, which is this council that we've talked about, approximately 70 to 71 members. It's led by the high priest, who is Caiaphas at the time, and it's made up of a group of high-ranking priests, elders, and scribes, who would have been the lawyers. And again, keep in mind, even though they have this underlying customary legal system, they're still under Roman control. And then the Roman government, as we know, is run by the emperor in Rome. He has appointed Pontius Pilate to be the governor at the time. And he basically, Pontius Pilate at least, has the full authority from Rome to do what needs to be done. Basically, his basic function, though, is keep the peace. We don't want all these people stirred up. We don't want riots. We don't want trouble in the streets. Whatever you do, Pilate, just keep the peace. That was his main function. So let's turn our focus then to those six stages of the trial that we talked about. First of all, the hearing before Annas. Now, this is referred to in the book of John 18, verses 13 and then 19 through 24. I'd recommend that you turn there. We're going to touch on some of those issues. First of all, I'll point out to you that this proceeding appears at least to be private. And of course, since it happens shortly after Jesus' arrest, we also know that it's in the middle of the night. And there really appears to be no legal reason for this appearance in front of Annas. Because at this point, he has no real power. At one point, he was in fact the high priest in charge of the Sanhedrin. But he had run into some legal difficulties with the Romans several years before that, and they had removed him. And of course, he was replaced by Caiaphas, who was in fact his son-in-law. So therefore, there appears to be no reason for this man to be involved in this process. But yet, the men who arrested Jesus took him straight there. That tells you something. That tells you this was all part of a pre-planned strategy. Okay? And it appears that the sole purpose of this meeting is to get Jesus to say something that will incriminate himself. In other words, before we get into the formal meeting, let's see if we can get him to answer some questions and admit to his crimes and to sort of streamline this process. So again, the fact is, there's no reason for this proceeding to occur, and since it did occur, and he was taken straight there after he was arrested, that really tells you that this was part of a pre-planned strategy by the high priest. At this hearing, he was in fact compelled to testify. And in fact, and this will sort of be a common theme throughout the rest of the night, he was in fact abused by the guards for not responding to his questions accurately. And again, if you think about this, if in fact Annas is a judge, what is his role? Well, his role is to make sure that the truth comes out, not to punish somebody before they're found guilty. And of course, at the end of this process, even though there's been no finding of guilt or innocence, he's bound up and he's taken to the Sanhedrin. Now, as we know, the Sanhedrin is this group of 70 men, again, a mixture of priests, elders, and scribes. And this one also appears to be private, because this examination by Caiaphas was done in Caiaphas's home. Also, as we know, it's still the middle of the night. And if you read the account of this trial, and let's go ahead and take a look at Matthew 26, verse 59 in Matthew 26. Says, "Now the chief priests, the elders, and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death." So remember when I said earlier, one of the roles of the judges is to make sure the truth comes out, to protect the sanctity of the process. Here, and not prejudge a defendant. Here, that's clearly not happening. It appears that the chief priest himself and the elders are all involved in the eliciting of testimony and witnesses. They were even involved in establishing his guilt by the use of false witnesses directly. In other words, this isn't a process where somebody walks in off the street randomly and says, "Oh yeah, I saw Jesus do this and that." The witnesses who appeared in front of the Sanhedrin were there because they were requested to be there by members of the council. Also, if you look at verse 63 in Matthew 26, it says, "But Jesus kept silent, and the high priest answered and said to him, 'I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God.'" Again, he's being compelled to testify against himself. He's being warned, "Hey, Jesus, you're under oath. Answer this question." So he's being compelled in violation of Jewish law. And of course, we're all familiar with the scene where Caiaphas reacts to God's answer. In verse 64, Jesus has responded to Caiaphas' prior question. And then in verse 65, it says, "Then the high priest tore his clothes, saying, 'He has spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look, now you have heard his blasphemy.' 'What do you think?' They answered and said, 'He is deserving of death.'" Well, basically, In verse 65, Caiaphas has pronounced Jesus guilty before the council has even been asked to vote. And of course, that's a level of undue influence. I think it's important to know that as the high priest, Caiaphas had a significant amount of influence over this council. If you're the lowest man in seniority in the council, and you're watching this whole process play out, and you have doubts in your mind about guilt, but then the head honcho rips off his clothing and pronounces him guilty before you've already have a right to vote, your natural tendency is going to want to go along with the guy in charge. And I think that's exactly what happened here. And of course, just like in the prior proceedings, Jesus was abused once again. So, a couple important things to take from this meeting with Caiaphas. And that is, we know for a fact that Caiaphas was involved in the plot to kill Jesus from the beginning. Let's take a look at John 11:53 for confirmation of that. It says, "Then, from that day on, they plotted to put him to death." And in fact, Caiaphas had even predicted Jesus' death, starting in verse 49, also in John 11. "And one of them, Caiaphas, being high priest that year, said to them, 'You know nothing at all, nor do you consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people and not that the whole nation should perish.'" So when Jesus is brought in front of the Sanhedrin and his quote-unquote trial is supervised by Caiaphas, it's clear that Caiaphas has already made up his mind, not just Caiaphas, but most of the men in the Sanhedrin as well. Also in this examination, let's want to jump over to Mark chapter 14. This is a part of the story that I think Mark tells better than the other Gospels. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but the section of Mark starting in 55 and ending in about 64 is important to this part of the story. First of all, what you find out real quickly is the level of involvement in the Sanhedrin in eliciting the false testimony. Starting in verse 56, "For many bore false witness against him, but their testimonies did not agree." In other words, these men had been recruited, in a sense, to come and tell stories and help find Jesus guilty, but they get there and they're telling different stories. And it's not matching. So, you know, there's likely to be, again, some of the younger members of the Sanhedrin not involved in the plot, scratching their head, wondering, well, wait a minute, what's going on here? So we've got this situation where the testimony of these false witnesses doesn't agree. It appears that Caiaphas recognizes he's got a problem. Okay? So what does he do? He stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, "Do you answer nothing? What is it? These men testify against you." But Jesus kept silent and answered nothing. Again, the high priest asked him, saying to him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" Jesus said, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven." So again, look at this situation. The witnesses that have testified against him haven't really helped the prosecution at all. They're telling stories. They're telling contradictory stories. They're not telling the same stories. They're not providing the same information. Caiaphas, recognizing that this isn't going the way he wants it to, knowing that he doesn't really have the right to compel Jesus to testify, asks him questions anyways. And of course, Jesus eventually does answer his questions. And what's the next thing that Caiaphas does? This is where he rips his clothing, says, "What further need do we have of witnesses? This man is guilty." In other words, he put on a big show to sort of hide the fact that they don't really have any other evidence other than God's own testimony. One more final thing about the examination in front of Caiaphas. Take a look at Matthew 26, 57. I think this may be as telling as anything about the proceedings that occurred that night. And this is immediately after his meeting with Annas. And it says, "And those who had laid hold of Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled." Now, it's the middle of the night, and men have been sent out to arrest Jesus. They bring him back into Jerusalem, and do they need to round up the Sanhedrin? No. They're sitting there twiddling their thumbs, waiting for him. If that doesn't offer further evidence of a conspiracy, I don't know what does. So again, keep in mind, this isn't a situation where he was sort of arrested out of the blue, and then when they got him, they've got to schedule something, and let's get all the Sanhedrin together. No, they're all sitting in Caiaphas' home in the middle of the night waiting for Jesus to appear. So that assembly breaks up. We have a third level of proceeding, and that is in the morning. Now, this story is best told in the book of Luke in chapter 22, verses 66 to 71. And basically what happens is, when morning finally arrives, they assemble again. And once again, Jesus is compelled to testify against himself. We don't know a whole lot more about what happened here, but it appears that the purpose for this meeting is simply to avoid trouble with the fact that all that other stuff we did in the middle of the night that we tried to keep secret, well, it's going to be hard to crucify this man if we kept everything under cover. So once the morning hits, and we're not subject to the rule against nighttime proceedings, let's assemble again and basically rubber stamp everything we did last night. And that's the purpose for this meeting. Again, it's the Sanhedrin simply meeting again, just confirming, if you will, the decision that they had made overnight. So now the Sanhedrin has made its decision. They send Jesus to Pilate. Now again, Pilate is the Roman governor, and as we know, it's important for the governor to be involved in the process because the Jewish tribunal does not have the power to exercise the death penalty. So now it's necessary to get Pilate involved. Luke 23, verses 1 through 7, tells this story. The first thing we learn is, well, now all of a sudden, the specific charges against Jesus have changed. Before, in the Sanhedrin, he was charged with blasphemy, which is a religious crime, if you will. Well, it appears that the Jewish leaders recognized the fact that Pilate could probably care less about that. Again, that's a religious thing. This is your God. You guys do what you need to do about that. I'm not going to punish somebody for blasphemy. So they come up with something different. And again, so now they're going to accuse him in front of Pilate of something completely different from the evidence that has already been supplied to them in their council. He's going to be charged with treason. Well, okay, what treason is that? Well, he's claiming to be the king. He's going around telling people not to obey the Roman ruler. Allegedly, not to pay taxes. Well, that Pilate does care about, because now we're in the realm of that stuff where, well, gee, if I let this guy skate on this kind of stuff, everybody will be doing it, and now I have trouble keeping everybody in line. So now they at least got Pilate's attention. But Pilate questions Jesus, and he finds no fault, no guilt. And basically, the Jewish mob that had now, by now, accumulated, even tried to use the old argument, well, gee, Pilate, if he wasn't guilty of something, we wouldn't be wasting our time here. Please punish him. Please punish him. But of course, Pilate refused to do so. At that time, Pilate found out that Jesus was from Galilee. And guess who was in town? Herod. Herod was the man who had control over that region. Well, Pilate says, well, we'll send him over to Herod, and we'll see if Herod can find some fault with him, but I find none. I'm done here. So once again, he's bound up, and he's taken before Herod. And you can find this story in Luke 23, verses 8 through 12. Now, the interesting thing about the appearance before Herod was this appeared to be more of a sideshow or entertainment for Herod. Herod, of course, was aware of Jesus' reputation for performing miracles, and Herod just thinks it'll be neat if Jesus will perform a miracle for him. Well, of course, that doesn't happen. There doesn't appear to be any attempt on Herod's part to find anything to punish Jesus for, and in fact, he makes no finding at all. He just returns him back to Pilate with no finding of guilt or innocence one way or the other. So now Jesus ends up back in front of Pilate. And now things are going to turn ugly. Now this story is best told in Luke 23, verses 13 through 25. Now, we don't know what kind of communication there was between Herod and Pilate that day. There may not have been anything of any significance. But the mere fact that Jesus was now back in front of Pilate again after having been in front of Herod, I think raises the presumption that Pilate could easily assume that Herod did not find any guilt. If so, he would have taken steps to punish him himself. There is further examination of Jesus, and Pilate decides that he's just going to chastise him and release him, once again thinking this will appease the Jews. The Jews, though, as we know, demand the release of Barabbas instead, who is a known and notorious thief. In other words, we would call him a lifer, a guy with a rap sheet. You know, everybody in town knows him, and he steals whenever he gets a chance. The Jewish mob, though, decides, no, we'd rather you release this man than Jesus. And once again, the common theme that keeps coming back throughout the night, Pilate decides to physically punish Jesus, again, once more to try to appease the Jews. In other words, you get this feeling that Pilate knows this isn't going to end well unless he takes some steps to control the process. So he's doing everything in his power to avoid having to make pass judgment on Jesus. So again, he has Jesus beaten. He acknowledges his innocence one more time, John 19, verse 4. And then he brings Jesus out. Now, and he's wearing a crown of thorns. And you got to get this mental picture. It's now late morning, perhaps early afternoon. Jesus was arrested in the middle of the night. He's been beaten, abused, both physically and psychologically, all night. He's probably bleeding profusely. His body is probably covered with his own sweat. And he's got to be physically exhausted. So Pilate parades him out in front of the crowd. He's covered in, again, his own blood, his own sweat. And he says, "Behold the man." Now, as a younger man, I struggled with what's the point of that phrase. But, you know, once you've been through life, you kind of figure it out. Jesus, or Pilate was basically saying, I can't do much more to this man without killing him. Look at it. He's a mess. that didn't work. He's basically saying, okay, folks, I think enough's enough. You've had your fun. I can't do anything more. And one more time, Pilate proclaims Jesus' innocence. That's in John 19, verse 6. So again, here we have Jesus standing before the mob. In a sense, Pilate is almost pleading for his mercy. The crowd won't give in, but in the end, Pilate, fearful of the mob for a lot of different reasons, some of it political, some of it just fearful of what could happen that day. If things got out of hand, he basically delivers Jesus to the mob for crucifixion. And of course, the rest is the crucifixion itself. Now, before we got started on those six aspects, we talked about the nature of Jewish law and some of the things that had to be followed in every case. And of course, as we went along, you probably caught some of the things that were wrong with the trial of Jesus. I'm just going to go through a brief list and summarize those things. But again, I will point out to you, I could probably come up with another two or three pages of things if we wanted to get super technical and take the time to do so. First thing is, clearly, this was not and never had the chance to be an impartial trial, especially as long as Caiaphas was in charge. At no point in the proceedings was there ever any presumption of innocence assumed on the part of Jesus. The proceedings were conducted mostly in the middle of the night, and again, several aspects of the proceeding were conducted in private, especially those first two. Also, not only were false witnesses used, the judges running the trial knew that those witnesses were false, and in fact, were probably involved in eliciting that testimony. Also, Caiaphas, as the high priest, rendered significant undue influence on the rest of the Sanhedrin. And also, at no point, other than his own remarks, was Jesus ever given an opportunity to defend himself. Now, think about that for a second. Since it was sort of a railroad process, depending upon how you look at the calendar, within 12 to 15 hours from the time of his arrest, he was on the cross. It's hard to imagine that in any legal system, any reputable legal system in the world today, but that's exactly what happened here. And why? Because Jesus at no point was given an opportunity to provide any evidence or any witnesses in his own defense. He was continuously compelled to testify against himself in violation of law. And in virtually every step in the process, save one, even though they seemed to be in a hurry, they took time to beat him up a little bit more. He was pronounced innocent several times by Pilate himself. The Sanhedrin passed its judgment on the day before the Sabbath and ignored the 3-day waiting period for capital cases. Those are just a few of the examples of everything that was wrong. And again, I could speak for another 2 hours, come up with another 2-page list if the time was not an issue. So that's the story of the trial of Jesus. In conclusion, a couple things to take from this lesson. I think we all know and understand the basic idea that Jesus knew in advance what his destiny was. Virtually everything that happened that day, or even in the last 12 to 15 hours, was expected by him, but was also done for us. It's safe to assume, though the Gospels don't go into it significantly, it is safe to assume that's sprinkled throughout the mob and the group that watched this day unfold, there were people there who loved and supported Jesus. But they were either afraid or simply drowned out by the mob. In other words, it's conceivable that some people tried to speak up for him, but were basically drowned out, shushed away probably. And people would have been afraid for their own lives because of the mob mentality. Today, we have the same situation. Just like that day, there are some who decide to stand with Jesus, and there are those who decide not to stand with Jesus. We all have decisions that we need to make every day on whether we're going to stand with Jesus or not. But if you're here and you've not been baptized and you are interested in living your life for Jesus, that means that you need to decide to stand with Jesus and not stand with the mob. I encourage you to make the decision today to do so, stand with Jesus, and decide that now is the time for you to be baptized as we stand and sing this song that's been selected.